chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Dr. Harold Pillsbury. A lot of his friends call him Rick. He is the Thomas J. Dark Distinguished Professor of
Otolaryngology.
Otolaryngology, head and neck surgery, and chair of that department. And he's in more interesting for me because he's the executive director of the Paul Biggers Carolina Children's Communicative Disorders Program. Paul Biggers was a hero of mine growing up as a football player rather than a doctor, both when he was in high school and at Davidson. And so I was interested in this work, which, Rick, we're going to talk about helping people who have hearing problems and then how that might help the rest of us. But tell us about how all this got started and about Paul Biggers and his dedication to children.
Well, Paul Biggers is one of my heroes, too. You know, he tried out for the Green Bay Packers after he played football at Davidson, and he just wasn't tough enough for Vince Lombardi. And that sort of is Paul's personality. He was just a big teddy bear. Everybody loved him. He was a kind, gentle person, and he turned into be a great ENT surgeon. And his generous spirit is what helped get this started. This Carolina Children's Communicative Disorders Program, CCCDP, kind of was born out of a issue we had in getting hearing amplification to children in the late 80s and early 90s. What happened is that I knew that there was no support from Medicaid for this at that time.
For what?
For children's hearing aids. So there, we'd see children from all over the state that would come to see us with problems.
I apologize for slowing you down.
That's
okay. But kids, I want to say lots of kids, but a significant number of kids can't hear.
Right.
And the government-supported medical programs would not provide the funds to give these kids a hearing aid, which would open the doors for them to learn, to participate, and to save hundreds of thousands of dollars down the line in support.
That's absolutely true. So
so how'd you get around that?
Well, the way we got around it is the way a lot of people get around problems, and that is to insert themselves into the solution. And so we didn't have a huge department then, but I went to the people I had and I said, look, you know, these poor kids can't hear. And, you know, every child sent to school by their parents with the idea that they could become the president of the United States. And the minute they get there, if they're deaf and they realize that, not deaf like totally deaf, but just hearing impaired, they realize that there's a whole world that they're just not able to participate in because they're not picking up all the cues when they should. So I went ahead and made a decision with my group that we would supply hearing aids to these children out of our own pockets. So our we dealt in hearing aids at that time, and they cost about $600 a pop then in the late 80s, in 89 or 90, and we could get them for $150 a piece.
So because you were... You're a distributor, or you're a...
We were dealing hearing aids
wholesale
through
or less
the university, right. So they would send us the hearing aids, and what we did is we took hearing tests from our group to start with, but then we expanded to audiologists throughout the state, and they'd send us hearing tests on children that... that were in bad shape, and we'd look at them, and if we thought they qualified for a hearing aid, we'd... you know, set them up with a hearing aid and send it out to the audiologist, and they would supply the hearing aid to the child. Well, I guess, you know, it sort of started growing, and by the time the third year had come around, we had spent $70,000 on hearing aids. That was 1991. And so there was an investigative reporter from the News and Observer that came over to our place, and they asked me if they could come, if they could record the conversation and all this sort of thing. But I didn't have anything to hide, so I said, sure. Well, the minute this really nice, sweet woman came there, and she said, well, so she sits down, opens up her pad, and starts asking questions. And it wasn't too far in before she said, Well, Dr. Pillsbury, you have $73,000 in miscellaneous equipment you've sent out, you've spent, and we were sort of interested in where that went. And I could tell she thought I'd bought some fancy Ferrari.
Where your yacht was.
Where my boat was at the beach, or if I had a beach house or whatever. And I could sort of chuckled because I knew that this was not going to go the way she wanted it to. So I said, well, you know, what we did is we spent that money to get about 400 or 500 hearing aids for little children all over the state. And she couldn't believe that. So I took her over to the clinic, and I showed her all the audiograms of a lot of these kids. And she was really taken by that. So it was one of those things that started off badly and turned out well. And so from then on, I thought, you know, so she wrote a different kind of article than the one she attended to. And Paul Biggers at that time, he said, you know, what can we do to capture this spirit? I said, well, Paul, if you can, you know everybody at the legislature, why don't you go over there and see if the state's interested in helping us? So in 1992, Paul started with a grant from the state of $260,000 to do this, and that got the ball rolling. And this year we are up to about $1.2 million or $1.5 million. So we're getting more and more money from the state because we're doing this for everybody. Now, Medicaid covers hearing aids right now for poor children, but the point is there are a lot of children with hearing loss that don't, there's nobody who's looking to test them because it's still a money-losing proposition. So we just developed a relationship with Mission Hospital in Asheville, and they have a children's hospital there, which is more of an outpatient center, and they don't do anything to test children's hearing. And the private community in town can't spend time because these little children, when they're like 6 months to a year and a half old, they can't really cooperate with a hearing test. So you have to kind of trick them, and you have to use sophisticated like ABR testing, auditory brainstem response testing. And it takes a lot of time, and time is money if you're in private practice. So we've developed a liaison between like Pat and Jack Roush, who are at our Pat and Jack, or Jack works for the graduate school and Pat works for the hospital. And Craig Buckman and me, we all went out there and we talked to him. And so we're going to develop an extension program out there in Asheville. And that's sort of the thing we do in many places to improve the opportunity for children with hearing loss to access
when,
help.
When are the times that you can identify and then with good results provide the kind of equipment that will give a child the ability to hear? I mean, how does that usually run? Or in an optimal situation, how does it
Well, run? In North Carolina, we helped pass a law that said every infant needs to be screened for hearing loss at birth. And that screening is about 99.5% successful, which is really amazing. But what happens is after that, the follow-through is where, you know, there's sort of a gap there. And if we find out they've got a hearing loss, then we keep checking them out. And about 20 to 30% of the kids who fail end up having a real problem. And we'll put hearing aids on them in the first 6 months of life.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
How do they keep them on? I mean,
well, they'd like to bat them off sometimes, but most of the time the child is getting benefit from something. Even at a young age, they tend to want to, you know, hearing is one of the primitive senses that has kept, you know, from the dawn of time, has kept animals from getting eaten up by other animals. So we have developed it in the human species to quite a sophisticated extent, and even as infants, children want to hear things. So they tend to cooperate with these hearing aids, and they do very well with them. And, you know, a lot of times by the time they're 1.5 or 2 years old, they'll search out that hearing aid to put it on. And, you know, they want to do well. They have a sense of this is good for me. And I feel really good about that because there's so many times when you try to do something and it doesn't work, or you don't realize that something's a big deal because kids don't have the capacity to complain. They figure whatever they were dealt in life is what they're going to get. And so the adult population has to sort of pick these kids up and carry them on their shoulders for a while and get them through the times that they're having trouble. And this is one of the things that we've been able to do, and we feel really good about it at UNC.
We're visiting with Dr. Rick Pillsbury. We're talking about deaf children and what we can do about it. He and I will be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Dr. Rick Pillsbury. We're talking about deaf children. And we're talking, I'm real interested in deaf children and what you can do for any child to sort of turn his or her life around from a situation that if there's no intervention, it's a disaster. And if there is intervention, it can often work out to be really, really good. A lot of we're talking about kids, I guess, who need hearing aids. There are kids who have profound deafness who, at least in earlier times, no hope. I mean, a hearing aid wouldn't do any good because they can't hear at all. And are there still kids like that?
Well, there are kids like that, and those kids need more than a hearing aid, and those kids are the ones that we do cochlear implants on. And a cochlear implant is a miraculous device that's put in surgically. In behind the ear, there's the child undergoes a general anesthesia, and we put the device into the cochlea, and then it stimulates the nerve that goes to the brain and restores their hearing and bypasses the part of the ear that would hear naturally. So it's an absolutely unbelievable device. We have, we've done well over 1,000 of them in North Carolina. And in fact, we used to have three really vibrant schools for the deaf that did a great job, but you know, there's, people are not very patient these days. So if the family of the deaf child could learn to sign, that's a big triumph, but nobody else in the community knows how to sign. So these cochlear implants allow these children to develop speech and hearing and participate in school in a normal stream, mainstream school, and go to college. And I can tell you that if you met some of the children that we've done these cochlear implants on, we do them bilaterally now in a lot of these
cases.
What
does that mean?
We put one on each side so they can have directional speech, stereo ears. And you know, we've got one of the schools for the deaf is closed, and the other two are just, you know, barely eking along. And
now, explain that to me. So the cochlear implant can – cure is not the right word, but can remedy the profound deafness in many or almost all cases? Or how does it – can it take care of every deaf person's problem?
Well, it takes care of almost all of them. There are some children that are multiply handicapped that have – but, you know, we had a little discussion at this at our national meeting this past couple weeks ago, and we discussed people that are multiply handicapped and, you know, have mental retardation, et cetera, and if you add deafness to whatever they've got, it just makes the whole problem worse. And so if we can correct the deafness, we can give these people a more meaningful life. Now, there comes a point at which they're so bad off you can't really help them.
But the limit then is the other problems rather than the deafness. What I'm trying to get you to do is to assert or to not or to back away from my idea that you can take almost any profoundly deaf person, let's just say a normal person except for deafness, and can give that person hearing.
Well, the one thing we do that we're pretty insistent on is we do an MRI on all these children and make sure they got an eighth nerve, which is the hearing nerve, that goes from the ear to the brain. If they have a nerve that goes from the ear to the brain and they have an inner ear that's anyway intact, we can do a cochlear implant
on them. But there's some, if they have this inner ear nerve problem, if that's not intact, then cochlear implants isn't going to be a solution. Is there any other solution for them?
Well, there's tactile hearing devices, and to some extent, these people. Well, it's amazing how industrious the society can be to help people. But it's instead of being all of them, it's about 2 or 3% of them. So we've got, you know, 97-98% of the deaf population that we can help with these cochlear implants. And we do need a deaf school to help the ones that we can't help. There's no question about that. But there's no parent who wouldn't want their child to go into a normal school and have a great chance to do anything in life that was available to them. And, you know, just because you're deaf doesn't mean you're not smart. So there are a lot of these deaf kids are really smart.
Well, there's also I'm sure you've thought about this a lot, but there's a deaf culture of some deaf parents who have a problem that comes down through the family. They believe that it's a blessing for the kid to be a part of the deaf culture and wouldn't want to deprive that kid. I mean, they would. I mean, there is. I mean, you know better than I do about what this is, but that there are, as we learn in the Gallaudet situation, when there was an argument about whether or not a hearing person could effectively be the president of that, and many of these people, or some of them, extol the benefits of the deaf culture. So you would have some parents who would say, "No, I don't. I'd rather teach my child signing in the language of deafness."
Well, that has occurred, but to be honest about it, that becomes less and less an issue as time goes by, and the reason for that is because cochlear implants have gotten really good. And you'd wonder, well, it doesn't seem like they would serve that many people and they're really expensive. What made them turn the corner and become so good? And the real truth is that it takes $100 million to develop a microchip. And there's not enough money in cochlear implants for a company to spend that kind of money to do this, because it just would completely wipe out any opportunity they had to stay in business.
You need to back up for me just a minute to explain to you why there's a chip in the cochlear implant that how that works. What difference does it make to have a $100 million chip in there?
Well, the reason why is because in order to process sound and turn it into hearing, you have to dissect the sound into all these different tones, because the inner ear is like a piano, and it has these different hair cells in it to respond to different frequencies. And so what the cochlear implant does is it takes the sound and dissects it into the frequencies and turns it into a digital signal, and then it stimulates the inner ear, which then the nerve to the inner ear that goes to the brain, and then that the nerve sends a signal to the brain, and the brain processes it so that it turns into
speech. I see. So it's a modern device that's dependent upon the digital technology that's developed in the last few years for MP3s and computers and things like that. That makes it possible to replace the loss of the cochlear.
The hair cells. Which are the hearing cells in the inner ear. And the fact of the matter is that the reason this has become a big deal is that in most countries, they don't have the landlines for telephones that we've got. So cell phones have become huge. And there are billions of cell phones out there. And so what happens is that if you're selling enough of something, $100 million doesn't sound like a bad investment. So what has happened is the people have developed these chips, and the chips have kind of been modified into the cochlear implants. And what has happened is the cochlear implants have become really good.
So the cochlear implants, not profitable in themselves, or not enough, massive enough to justify a lot of this kind of electronic research, just goes in and takes advantage of the research that's accompanied the millions or billions of cell phones that are competing for our competing all over the world.
Absolutely. And so what has happened is that the cochlear implants have become so good that we have several parents where both parents are deaf and they bring their child in for a cochlear implant, because every parent wants their child to have a chance to succeed in the world. And at the end of the day, you know, if you're a parent, you'd like to think that when you're dead and gone, your child's going to be able to function independently. And this is the capacity. The capacity to function independently is based on, in these children, the capacity to hear. We're a very impatient society. You know, if you tell somebody or ask them a question and they don't get it right, and then have to ask them again, after the second time, you're just going to ignore them. And there's nothing worse than getting shut out of every conversation on the planet. So people realize that, and they've wanted their kids to get these. So the deaf culture group is an aging group, and it's not being added to by very many people.
Well, you know, the real test would be if the parents came in and said, okay, I've got one for my child's had one, and it's working for my child, and I'd like to communicate with my child. Can you got one for me? Can you do it for an adult?
Well, we can, but the thing about this whole thing is that the brain learns where the input's coming from. And if you take somebody who's been signing for years, you know, maybe a 40-year-old person, and you do a PET scan on them and you give them, you start talking to them, the part of their brain that lights up isn't the same part of their brain that would have lit
up.
So
the brain solidified like an aging brain sometimes does, so that the parent can't learn to – can get the signals but can't process them the same way a child can do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, I will be honest with you. I have – because things have gotten so advanced, I've taken some adults and I've said, look, you know, let's try one of these and just see what happens with it, because if you get anything out of it, if you can hear a fire alarm or some kind of a siren coming down the road, you can protect yourself from bad things that happen. And in fact – I'm selective with adults who've been deaf since childhood. So I don't do very many of them. But because I'm selective, the ones I've done have generally had, they say, you know, it's not the same as some of these other people I see that have an implant. But I feel like it's an asset to me.
Well, we're visiting with Dr. Rick Pillsbury. We're talking about deafness and the kinds of things that can be done right here in Chapel Hill to improve, maybe... substantially improve the lives of a lot of kids. He and I will be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Dr. Rick Pillsbury. We're talking about deafness and the kinds of things that can be done right here in Chapel Hill for children and for adults. And we started talking about technology a few minutes ago, Dr. Pillsbury. And I tell you, I thought of you when I saw this ad on television during the football game. There's this kid who goes, he's got his cell phone and he's visiting
a foreign country.
A foreign country. He's visiting Italy, I think. And he comes in and he tells his telephone. He said, I'm here in this village where my grandfather was born. And then he hands it to this old fella in the village, and it comes out in Italian. Same stuff, translated. And when we talked earlier, there's a reason that maybe some of the rest of us would like to get cochlear implants, even though we can hear. And there's an amazing kind of drive of technology that's going to profoundly change the things that are possible for us as humans. Talk to us about that.
Well, the whole business of being able to translate from one language to another is part of the if you take a chip that's worth $100 million, it can do more than just digitalize the sound and transmit it to the nerve. These cochlear implants have the capacity, if the desire was there by the companies, to radically change the way we interact with other people. And in fact, you could be in a – now, it wouldn't – unless somebody else had one, if you're speaking English – and you're in a country where they're speaking German or French or Italian, they could speak to you in Italian, and the implant could actually translate it into English or German into English or anything into English. But and you would understand it, but you wouldn't be able to, unless you had a digital device like that boy does in that ad, you couldn't talk back to him. But that would be easy. That's an easy thing to do. So let's just say they speak to you in Italian, and your cochlear implant understands it and gives you the English translation. Then you talk into a machine in English and then put that up to somebody's ear, and they understand, they listen to your question in Italian. Now, you're not going to have a philosophical conversation that way, but most of the interactions we have with people are very basic, and, you know, with a vocabulary of several hundred words, you can get a lot done. And this is definitely in the wheelhouse of what's going to happen. There's no question about it. The other thing it can do is there are a lot of people with memory problems, and you can store a ton of information in these things and just sort of say to yourself ask a question like, who was the King of England in 1540? And the thing can come back and say, that was Henry VIII. So, I mean,
talk to yourself, in right. other words, so you could, cochlear implant designed for deafness, you know, originally, but it works for other.
Right.
Well, I mean, for me, I mean, no, stop real quick, because I'm more worried. My hearing is just doing great, but my memory is going
Yeah, I know how that feels.
So you're talking about something that is of imminent practical value. Where did I leave my keys? Or no, you can't ask or you could tell it where you've left your keys, and then
Could do that, or you could say because you would have to program it with information that it would know. But things like the names of people and who's the senator from North Carolina, and then you'd say. Then it would know it was Richard Burr, so you'd say, or Kay Hagan. So you would have it programmed with information. So what you would do is you would go through your you'd have to write a list of issues that was important to you. And then you would program those into the device so that when you ask the question at a later time, it could give you the answer. And my father-in-law is in assisted living, and he is vexed by the lack of capacity to remember things he knows are basic. He knows he's got a memory problem, but he can't do anything about it. So these kind of things, I'm not going to sit there and tell you it's going to solve this issue, but any little thing you can do to help is a step in the right direction.
Well, I don't want to call it a crutch. I mean, but a crutch can be very useful to somebody who needs one. And a mental crutch, the kinds of mental crutches that are convenient and practical. A checklist is helpful for me now. If I could expand that as my memory continues to decline, it gives me a lot of hope for the possibilities of maybe not being so handicapped down the line.
Well, those things are – they're not there right now. I mean, they can do them, but they haven't started doing them. The things I'm talking about translating languages and helping you remember things, are in the wheelhouse of what could be done. It's just that they haven't activated that part of the equation yet.
Well, one of the – you seem to have a great interest in the technology that accompanies this and the relationship between the physician and the surgeon using these devices and the engineers and other kinds of scientists who are not on your wavelength. Are you wowed by these people? Are they your colleagues that you can talk to? And when you go to these conferences, are they there to brainstorm and to sell you on the new capabilities of these devices?
Well, it's very interesting. I am a full professor in the medical school, but I'm also a full professor of biomedical engineering at NC State and UNC. So we have, there's a lot of interest in engineering, and what we think of as engineering is making new gadgets. But in fact, the kind of speech coding strategies and the software and tissue engineering, all that kind of stuff is part of engineering. And, everybody thought at some point it'd be fabulous if we had a medical engineering school at UNC, and it'd be fabulous if we had a medical school at NC State. But in fact, I think the fact that engineering is such a huge deal at NC State has made them fabulous in engineering. I think the students, and we have a lot of students from NC State to come over to our place, and we do combined projects with them, and they're just brilliant. And they really put the pedal to the metal in terms of advancing the frontiers in engineering. We do the same thing over here in medicine, so it's a synergistic relationship. And I really love it. I mean, I think it's great. I go over there all the time.
So you're an engineer too.
Well, I guess
so. Well, you're a professor of engineering.
But that would be me.
But what you're pointing out to those of us who are not following this, the developments in education and in these fields, that engineering, as it shifts into more processing, I don't want to say processing numbers, but the digital kinds of engineering and the processing of codes and as you say, translating digits into the kinds of things that operate in your brain. I mean, all of that, those are cross currents in both medicine and—
It's called the brain-mind interface, the brain-mind interface. That's where you go from a signal and turn it into a thought.
Well, now you got me really going because what we've been talking about hearing signals, the kinds of sounds that are— are by the cochlear implant are processed into what is like telephone waves or like the kinds of digital things that go through our telephone lines and then into the brain. And then you've got to help teach the engineers what kind of waves the brain will understand as sounds. I mean, all of that interacts. What else is going on?
Well, that actually is a field called psychoacoustics. And I have four of the most famous, world-renowned psychoacousticians, PhDs in my department at UNC that are just doing brilliant work, heavily funded by NIH, to help work on these problems. And they really are, they work with children, they work with adults, they find different techniques to change signals so that they're more beneficial to the hearing of somebody so that they can process the signals. And, you know, they work with people who have issues that are problems and how you can correct those problems. And they really direct the traffic of what to do with the hardware technology by looking at the software issues and the brain-mind issues and saying, look, you know, here's where we need to apply another problem, another solution. Like one of the things in cochlear implants was there was a thought that if we have a very fast signaling rate, that it would be fabulous for the patient. So we had a 90,000 signals per second, or then we went to 125,000 signals per second. And my guy said, you know, that just doesn't make sense because the brain can't process that information fast enough. And so what they did is they said, you know, if we slow it down and separate these signals, our comprehension of the signal will be increased. And it was one of those things where the engineers had developed something they thought sounded great, but the people who actually work on that at where the rubber meets the road said, no, you guys are going the wrong direction.
It's a, I mean, the guys who understand the brain signals say, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. It's kind of like this is going at such a high rate that the brain can't understand it. So you got to pull it back a little bit.
Absolutely.
So that we can hear it again.
The other thing is there were a couple of these companies that had a very short electrode with 22 signals in it, or 24 signals in it, 24 electrode pads in a 20-millimeter electrode. There's another company that has a 31-millimeter electrode. It only has 12 electrodes that are equally spaced. And we found that that company does very well, even though they have fewer electrodes, because they're spaced along the entire inner ear. And, you know, it's like if you have a piano and you use the whole keyboard and you space these 12 channels equally among the keyboard, you're going to tell the difference between the several channels you've got. And so that, those are the kind of things that, and that's an engineering problem.
Well, we're visiting with Dr. Rick Pillsbury. We're talking about hearing and the kinds of devices and technology that are improving hearing for deaf people and opening lots of doors for those of us who might need help in other areas. He and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Dr. Rick Pillsbury. I don't even want to talk about who you are because... you're just the boss over there. And the reason I can't get into it is because I can't say otolaryngology.
Otolaryngology. Well, otolaryngology. It's actually ENT, ear, nose, and throat. And so whenever I'm out on the road, I just use ENT, head and neck surgery, and everybody knows what I'm talking about.
Are you – you're a surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to be a general practitioner too, don't you? I mean, do you just take – take orders from general practitioners? I mean, you've got to look into somebody and understand their whole health before you can start cutting into their...
well, of course, that's true. We have a medical and surgical wing of what we do. But, you know, the whole practice of medicine has become so complicated that everybody's looking at an organ system or a region. You know, if you have an eye issue, you're going to probably go to an ophthalmologist sooner or later. There's a general practitioner can identify there's an eye problem, but you're going to have to go to a person who does that for a living because the knowledge base has expanded so much that there's no single person that can really encompass all the information in everything that's out there. So we have a medical and surgical aspect of our residency. We do a lot of surgery, but most of the people in private practice or even in academic medicine do a couple of days of surgery a week and 3 days of clinic. Yeah. Because that's, you know, when people are sent to us, they're sent to us with a problem, and our job is to make a diagnosis.
I want to move back to your role as a professor over in engineering over at North Carolina State University and have you dream with us just a little bit about some of the opportunities that may not be, maybe even out of your field, that the new devices. And let's start this way. Let's start with hearing aids. And those of us who are getting along in years start thinking about, well, if I'm fortunate enough to live a few more years, I'm going to have some hearing loss. But I don't want to wear one of those big old bulky things that my granddaddy wore. I want, and can you give me something, one of those little chips? Can you put it up there so it doesn't show too? I mean, are there options for me, cosmetic options, so I won't have to show off to everybody that I've got a hearing aid?
Well, there are cosmetic options, and you can get these small little IT in the ear aids, and you can wear the ones that go behind the ear. I will tell you that it depends on what kind of hearing loss you've got, what kind of hearing aid would be best for you. For the person who has a high-tone hearing loss but their low tones are okay, it's better to have a vent or like a tube that goes through the ear mold that lets you get normal hearing in there for the low tones, and this is the hearing aid for the high tones. And so open mold hearing aids, you can't put a jelly bean in your ear and be able to have an open mold in it because there's not enough real estate there. So for somebody who needs a general amplification that's not too high, you can use one of those little in-the-ear aids that has a little hair that comes out of it. You can pull it in and out. Mm-hmm. But the more the sophistication of the hearing loss and the more you need in terms of fixing it, the more likely you are to have to wear an aid that goes behind the ear. But they're not that big anymore compared to where they used to be. A lot of the miniaturization and everything we do has affected this. And I guess the other thing is I see people with these Bluetooth things, and it looks like they got a boogie board on the side of their head. And so I think the whole implication of having a hearing aid on the side of your head just fits in with the kind
of
technology we're using.
You have something in your hand that looks like you're talking to your boss with your telephone, and nobody will know that you're just an old codger who needs hearing help.
Well, you don't need to have something on your hand. You can wear a whole thing behind your ear.
Right, and pretend like you're talking on the phone.
Right. The old days of having a gord that was sawed off on both ends, you're looking at, those days are long gone.
What else is happening in the realm of digitization that excites you, even though it might be not directly related to your field?
Well, I look at some of the computerization of information, and I think of in terms of iPods and, these cell phones are just unbelievable these days. You can bring signals and information to people and change. I mean, my wife always chews on me because she says, "You're on that phone all the time. That phone is a part of you." Well, I've got one of these later edition iPhones, and it really is pretty awesome. And especially on a Saturday where I'm trying to follow college football, if I'm not there, we had an interesting weekend this weekend. We went to the UNC game and left and went to the NC State game. So that was kind of fun.
Is that right? You went to both?
Oh, yeah. That was great.
They both won,
too. It was wonderful. Yeah. It doesn't happen too often. But that happened, and it was kind of fun.
Well, now, you were wearing your Carolina blue bow tie right now, but did you switch off and put on a red tie when you get to State?
I don't wear a tie on Saturday afternoons, but I do have an NC State engineering tie that they gave me over there, and I thought that was really kind of cool.
That's great. Well, I wonder what is happening outside the realm of technical devices in medical education as you see it. You run into a lot of old doctors, and they say it's just not the way it used to be. And then you run into some who say, you know, we got the greatest group of kids coming through the medical school and through our residency programs. Don't worry. We got smart people coming to help. How do you feel about it?
Well, I think that we really have a tremendous capacity to transmit information much better than we ever did. But there's no substitution for the so-called detective work that it takes to see a person and extract the information out of them that you're going to need to make a diagnosis. And sometimes it's information that people don't want to talk about, you know. Maybe somebody comes in and they're not feeling well, and it turns out 40 years ago they abused drugs when in the 60s, and now all of a sudden they got hepatitis C, or you know, they were doing various things. They smoked and drank when they shouldn't have, and they've now got some problem that they wouldn't have liked to have had, an air digestive or upper airway or, you know, oral cancer or something. So you've got to be able to sit down and talk to people. And I hate to think that we're going to advance the educational realm where we talk about all the information, we forget about how to talk to the patient. And I think that's the biggest challenge that we have right now, is teaching our medical students how to talk to the patient and extract a diagnosis from the information. Because, you know, we tell everybody that 90% of making the diagnosis is in the history.
It's interesting because, my preconceived idea is that a lot of times smart people, the smartest people, the ones who've got the best analytical skills, are not the best generally at communicating with people. You know, and that a lot of the communicators who are the best communicators don't have the intellectual, often don't have the intellectual gifts to really take it to the second level analytically. So you're looking for special types of people who got both those skills.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things that we look for in prospective medical students are people who've done some socially active thing. You know, if they've been in a Peace Corps or they've worked in a homeless shelter, I mean, the kind of volunteer at the hospital, those are the kind of things you look for in people.
In addition to being smart.
Absolutely.
Well, talking about being smart, I can't count, and I haven't counted the time right. So right as we begin a conversation about something very important, Dr. Fields, we're out of time.
But
it's been great.
No,
it's just been great, and I've enjoyed and learned so much from you, and appreciate your sharing what you're doing with your neighbors here in Chapel Hill.
Well, DG, I've had a great time. I really appreciate you inviting me over here, and it's been a wonderful opportunity to get to talk to everybody.
Thanks to Dr. Pillsbury, and thanks all y'all for listening. It's DG Martin Who's Talking. I'll be back here before you.